Till Death Do Us Part is a lighthearted and sometimes satirical true crime podcast where we present our dysfunctional married take on serious cases involving other dysfunctional relationships. We hope you enjoy.
Hello, and welcome to the 118th episode of Till Death Do Us Part.
I am your co-host, Daniel.
And I'm Melissa. Happy birthday, Daniel.
I have officially reached middle-aged.
You have.
Assuming I die.
At 90.
At 90.
Okay, that's okay.
It's a good goal.
You can die at 90, I think.
100 is good. I like 100, but who knows?
You look really good to me for being 45.
Yeah, but your eyesight is going, so.
It is, but I have my glasses on right now, so. Mm-hmm. That works. You are very attractive.
Thank you.
I kind of want to kiss you right
Easy.
Now.
Easy. Everyone's throwing up.
This is a family show. No, it's not, actually. This is not a family show. If this is the first time that you've ever listened to this dysfunctional podcast hosted by a dysfunctional married couple, welcome. What we do is I tell Daniel cases of love gone horrifically wrong where people in a relationship kill the other person in their relationship. I tell Daniel all about it and I get his horrific response. And sometimes we make fun of things. Sometimes we call out red flags. We never make fun of the victim. We are actually here to advocate for the victim. And our goal is that if one person listening to the show sees that their relationship is mirroring a relationship that I'm telling Daniel about, that they get out of that situation.
Run away.
That is our goal.
Yep.
One person.
We are big advocates for divorce.
We are. We might get divorced someday. You never know.
As opposed to murder.
Well, yeah, we're not going to murder each other.
We're not suggesting you get divorced for no reason. We're saying before you murder each other or get murdered, why don't you divorce?
Or just break up. Because a lot of times people aren't even married. We do talk about how we would kill each other, though, should someday we feel so inclined.
It's usually pipe in the observatory.
I want an observatory so bad.
Poison in the library.
Poison. Poison sounds good.
No. It's usually horrific and you start coughing and vomiting up blood.
Well, it depends on what type of poison.
Oh, okay.
All right. Well, we won't get into that. But you do need to do Patreon shoutouts because I missed the last episode.
Sorry.
Because we are very professional. And we do not have a producer. We do not have a writer. We do not have an editor. We are it. So
it.
Sometimes we're going to sound professional and sometimes you're going to be like, yeah, they're doing this in their spare room.
We are.
Of their house.
We are in our full-blown production studio. And we do this in cracks of time in between our jobs and kids and life and all the rest of it that everyone else is having to do as well. So there you go.
Yeah.
Patreon, thank you guys so much. We really appreciate it. We would love to thank Taylor S. Thank you so much, Taylor. Liz S. Thank you, Liz. Kristen C. Thank you, Kristen.
Just Jen with two N's.
We want to thank Just Jen with two N's. Thanks, Jen. And Karen D. Thank you so much, Karen. You guys make it so much easier.
To keep going.
Worthwhile. I don't know what the words are. I'm not a wordish person.
You're not a wordsmith. Yeah. We appreciate everybody who downloads and listens to this, really.
Absolutely.
Patreon is, that's our community. That's people who pay a little extra every month to hear all the extra episodes that we put out monthly. And we just thank you for that. We are able to keep going because of the Patreon. So
yep.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Daniel, do you have some factoids for me?
I'm going to be honest. This was your idea. So if you guys like it, don't give me any props. It was all Melissa. If you hate it, It wasn't me. It was
I'm
Melissa.
Trying to no. send you factoids based on what is happening in our life because it seems to be a little bit easier.
She wants me to do factoids on birthdays.
We haven't done one before.
Because
I wanted to hear where birthdays came from.
Because of the way that it is. Greeks added candles to cakes.
Oh.
In ancient times, the ancient Greeks offered round-shaped cakes to Artemis, the goddess of the moon. Also, that's where people enjoying getting mooned came from. No, not true.
Oh.
As a form of tribute, they lit candles to make the cakes shine like the moon.
That's, so that's cute. Fun. That's a Artemis. Cute idea. Artemis.
We should have named our son Artemis.
Still can.
And I'm like, what is wrong with you? In the United States, the most common birth date falls on September 9th, while the least common is on Christmas Day, December 25th.
I wonder why.
I don't know.
What is 40 weeks before September 9th?
I'm not a mathematician.
Is it Thanksgiving?
Do you want me to do the math?
People banging on Thanksgiving?
Probably.
All right. That's the last thing I want to do after a big meal, but hey, to each their own.
Okay. It says, we mostly sing the Happy Birthday to You song in English, but did you know that the song was composed by two American sisters, Patty Hill and Mildred J. Hill, in 1893? The song was initially created as a simple classroom greeting song titled Good Morning to All. It was later adapted with the lyrics we now associate with birthdays.
That's cool. I wonder if they copyrighted the Happy Birthday song.
Probably
if
not.
If someone out there gets money every time we sing it.
It would be hard to
No, you wouldn't be able to do that. No.
That. In some cultures, birthdays are tied to superstitions. For example, in Russia, it's considered bad luck to celebrate a birthday before the actual date. May-born individuals are believed to be lucky in love, while October babies are associated with a long life. Oh!
Ooh, yay me.
You're going to live forever.
As long as I outlive you, so I can spend your money.
Statistically, probability. Birthstones. Each month has a special gemstone associated with known as a birthstone. From the shimmering sapphire of September to the radiant ruby of July, birthstones add a touch of personalization to birthday gifts. Do you know what my birthday stone is? It's a kidney stone. That's not true. I just made that up. Anyway.
Oh, my God.
Birth flowers. Just like birthstones, each month has a birth month flower associated with it, and each also has a special meaning. I don't know what any of them are. I didn't look it up.
Mine are either.
Because I don't care. Nobody else does. Based on the position of the sun at the time of your birth, you are assigned one of the 12 zodiac signs. Each sign has its unique traits and characteristics.
Yes.
Sure.
People really follow that. I kind of look at mine and it does fit, which is good. But that, I mean, okay, cool. Like ours together. What, you're an Aries and I'm a Libra. We're supposed to be good friends.
That seems fine.
And not very good not, lovers.
Not good at anything else. Perfect. We are great roommates.
We're best friends.
Oh, boy. The golden birthday. The golden or lucky birthday happens when you turn the age of your birth date. For example, if you're born on the 20th, your golden birthday was when you were 20. Well, that's dumb.
I know.
So how the hell would I know that when I was seven? Whatever.
Our kids is, I mean, if you were born on the 21st of a month and then it's your 21st birthday, that's a golden birthday. That's a big deal.
I think they just go with ones that seem significant and ignore the other ones.
Yeah, but 21, you can drink. So imagine being 21, say in New Orleans. Oh, wait, can you drink at 18 in New Orleans?
No, not anymore.
Okay.
That was the last state, though, to raise the drinking age, I believe. Don't quote me, but I'm pretty sure that's true.
That or Mississippi.
It was one of the last states, yeah, to raise it.
That's why they're awesome. Anyways, so you say you're 21, born on the 21st of the month, and you're in Vegas.
Right.
Or Bourbon Street.
Right.
That is awesome.
Yeah. You, too, can experience alcohol poisoning. Okay, but okay, let's say I was born on the second. What, when I'm two, that's my golden eight? That doesn't make any sense.
Or the first.
Right.
All right, well, mine happened a really long time ago.
The birthday paradox, also known as the birthday problem, refers to the probability that in a group of 23 people, there's a 50% chance that at least two people have the same birthday. It is known as a paradox because it is counterintuitive and our brains just cannot handle the compounding exponents. There is so much mathematicals going on in that
sentence
paragraph I just read that I'm going to skip it and go on to the next one.
Okay. No one likes math.
Leap day birthdays.
That just happened.
People born on February 29th, a date that occurs only every 4 years, often celebrate their birthdays on February 28th or March 1st in non-leap years. I think it's fun to schedule appointments for people and say, well, when can I see you? And you go, February 29th. And they're like, oh, okay, great. And then they finally realize that that doesn't exist other than once every 4 years. Worldwide, a child's inaugural birthday, meaning their first birthday, is perceived as an important landmark. Hence, it's typically commemorated with grandeur and fanfare. We just missed my nephew's first birthday because we are assholes.
We did. Our sweet little nephew turned one a couple days ago.
Yeah.
And we missed his birthday. But we have teenagers who are involved in a lot of things. And
I had to work. It was insane.
I know, but we're jerks.
All right. Well, now that we got that over with, birthday meals. Now, this is something we can wrap our hands around. In many cultures, there are specific meals or dishes served just for birthdays, such as, for example, in China, a common birthday meal is a type of long noodle known as longevity noodles, symbolizing long life.
That's really cute.
In Korea, they celebrate birthdays by drinking seaweed soup. Mmm, that's my favorite.
Delicious.
Seaweed soup is a traditional dish that mothers often prepare, and having it on birthdays is a symbol of...
You need glasses, sir.
I'm trying to read through a mic. Filial piety. F-I-L-I-A-L. Symbol of filial piety. And a way to honor and thank one's parents.
But the mom's making it.
Seaweed soup. In other words, you take a sip and almost gag and throw up. But you don't because you want to show respect to your mother.
Is that
I think that's what they just said.
All right, I get it.
I'm done after this. Because after this, you will want to be done. World's longest birthday cake. Because why not? Currently measures 5,300 meters.
What is that in English?
17,388 feet.
No. How?
This was achieved by the Bakers Association at Thrissur, Kerala, India on January 15th, 2020. 17,388 feet of cakeage.
Was it baked?
It says it was achieved by the Bakers Association.
Oh, so it's a bunch of bakers coming together probably and doing it.
That's one hell of a big oven.
Well, that's cool.
I'm assuming they baked pieces.
And then put them together.
A cake at a time and stacked them. And
stacked them.
Stacked.
Put them out long ways.
Joined them.
That's pretty cool.
End to end, tip to tip.
It's kind of like Hands Across America, except it's cake across India.
Anyway, yeah, so a lot of cakes put together.
What do you want as your birthday dinner tonight that you probably have to make yourself? I forgot to ask you what you wanted.
Probably tacos.
Really?
Except I should have thawed stuff, so probably not.
Do I have to go to the store?
Nope. I'll just thaw it now.
Okay.
Do we have stuff to make tacos?
I don't know. I don't know.
Maybe nothing. We'll just fast. It'll be fine.
I got some bone broth in there.
Perfect.
All right, we'll do that.
All right, that's enough of that.
Thank you for your factoids, darling.
All hung up now and ended your listening pleasure, displeasure.
Daniel.
Yeah?
You ready for my case?
Do I have a choice?
No, you don't. All right. This is the case of Sean and Sheila Goff with Joy Risker.
Very pale.
No, it's Goff. G-O-F-F.
Goff? Oh, not Goth.
Not okay. Goth.
Gotcha.
On December 31st, 2003, in a desolate area of the Arizona desert, between the unincorporated community of Sentinel and the small town of Gila Bend, a man named Mark Goldsberry was camping with his wife and their two dogs over the New Year's holiday.
In case any of you are like, you know what, I'd really like to go camping out in the desert, just look up Gila Monster, and then you won't.
Well, these people did.
It's a big-ass giant desert lizard, and they're poisonous, I believe. I forget. They're pretty ferocious-looking creatures. They're called Gila Monsters.
Okay.
All right. You're welcome.
All right. So Mark's out there camping with his wife and their two dogs. While on a walk, Mark noticed a large Palo Verde tree with a large pile of lava rocks stacked neatly underneath, which was obviously man-made.
Sure.
As Mark investigated closer, he began to smell a faint odor, sort of like rancid meat.
Oh.
He decided to turn back around and to leave the pile alone, but did tell his uncle, Reuben Conda Sr., about the strange discovery since the uncle happened to live in the area. On January 9th, 2004, Reuben Sr., who also happened to be a local hunting guide, arrived at the man-made looking shrine. So he was curious, so he went out there to see it, stating that the rock pile was too big to have an animal or dog buried there, and that once he got to smelling, it was a different smell than an animal.
Ooh.
So he knew something was off and called his son Reuben Jr., who just happened to be a federal ranger with the Bureau of Land Management.
Oh, good. Okay, so there is some sort of law enforcement notification going on.
There is.
Okay, good. Because I was going to say, like, that's great that you guys are telling all your friends. Maybe tell someone, you know, who could do something.
Well, he wasn't telling all his friends. He was telling his uncle, like, no, hey, I found this thing. It's right. A little weird. He knew it was a little off. The next day, January 10th, the Uncle Reuben and his son took the Agua Caliente Road exit off of Interstate 8, drove until the pavement ended, then traveled half a mile on an abandoned road, and then proceeded down a primitive one-lane road till reaching the rural area. So are you picturing this?
Yeah.
Okay, this is very out there.
It's out in a rugged desert.
Yes.
It's very...
Which is kind of my favorite landscape,
arid,
to be honest. But this is like really out there.
Anything down there south, close to the border, is pretty bad. The nice thing about
the terrain is harsh.
Yeah. The nice thing about that is when you say one lane road, you think, oh gosh, you can't see cars coming. There's no such thing as trees and bushes out there.
No, you can see everything.
You can see for 100 miles in any direction, typically. So.
After taking photos of the rock pile and the surrounding scene, Reuben Jr. began to dismantle the pile of lava rocks.
And this is the ranger dude.
He worked for BLM.
Okay.
So he was removing the rocks one by one, noticing the foul odor growing stronger. After removing some of the rocks, Jr. uncovered what appeared to be human hair and a possible human leg.
Oh, boy.
This was obviously a body.
And this was January?
Mm-hmm. January 10th.
Okay, so it's cold because it's not a billion degrees yet, which it normally would be down there.
Right.
So.
But we don't know how long the body's been there.
Right. But if it was during the summertime, that thing would be covered in, you know, animals and creatures until it was gone.
That's true.
It actually would decay very quickly because it's hot.
But it was tall. Like, there was a huge stack of rocks over this body.
Almost like a shrine.
That's what I said. Yeah, it looked like a shrine. And then there were little rocks kind of stacked in a tower form. So it made it super obvious that there was something in there.
Well, the terrain out there, depending on where it is, it can be really sandy in the lows, but up higher, it's rock. There's no digging holes because it's a desert.
Right.
So unless it's in a sandy wash, then it, you could dig. But otherwise,
I can't
imagine
how hard that ground was.
Yeah,
in that area,
can't be easy.
That's probably why there were rocks on top of the body.
Right, that's what I mean. So instead, they just put the body in the ground, stack rocks on top of it.
The Maricopa County Sheriff's Department was contacted, and two officers arrived on the scene. Further excavation revealed a partially mummified body lying on its side with the legs tucked up in a semi-fetal position. Law enforcement also found some gray duct tape, pieces of a plastic bottle, a plastic hook, and two cigarette packets. Tire tracks were found to the east and south of the rock pile. Once the grave site was processed, the body was taken to the medical examiner's office in Phoenix, Arizona. Dr. Laura Fulganiti, a forensic anthropologist, determined that the body was that of an African-American woman who had suffered serious traumatic injuries. She had been stabbed at least 12 times in the chest, and one of the stab wounds had gone directly into her heart.
Oh, God.
It appeared that whoever had murdered the woman had tried to decapitate her as well. There was severe blunt force trauma to the cranial facial area. Her face was completely obliterated from the brow bone down. All her teeth had been removed with some sort of object, and a top portion of her mandible and bottom jaw were missing. And last but not least, all of the woman's fingertips had been cut off from the first knuckle down and disposed of. They weren't there. They didn't have her fingertips.
Holy crap.
Leaving no way to identify this woman.
Okay, gotcha. So they removed any identifying parts of the body like teeth, facial recognition,
and fingerprints.
Fingerprints.
Yes.
That's horrific.
In 2004, it was extremely expensive to have DNA extracted from human remains and analyzed. Without a concrete lead on who this murdered woman could possibly be, the expense to the county could not be justified. Instead, a forensic artist was used to make a sketch of the woman's face, using her skull and what bones were left, plus modeling clay to fill in the areas that were missing.
Wow. Just so they could kind of get a guess as to what she looked like.
Right. A composite was created and sent to other surrounding counties and news outlets. For 6 months, the woman's sketch was circulated throughout Arizona. In June of 2004, a Maricopa detective took a closer look at a photo on a flyer for a missing 16-year-old girl from Los Angeles. She looked like the sketch of the woman from the desert.
Oh.
Based on the visual match, they were able to finally justify the expense and extract the DNA from the Jane Doe and compare it to the DNA from the missing girl's family members. So all because this one detective said, hey, the sketch from the woman found in the desert looks like this missing 16-year-old girl from Los Angeles. So then they finally were like, okay, well, now we'll pay for DNA to be extracted from the bones of the woman found in the desert.
Wow.
So they needed some sort of lead.
Sure.
They had to have a lead and able to justify it. Now, it was not a match to the 16-year-old girl from Los Angeles, but the DNA sample had made its way into the FBI database.
Okay.
So within days, there was a match.
Oh, okay.
To a missing woman in San Diego, California, 25-year-old Joy Risker, the beautiful mother of two very young boys who had not been seen or heard from since September 19th, 2003. And the body was found in January.
Right, right.
So we had quite a few months in between there.
So it's a good thing someone did put together a sketch. And essentially right. Try to put back together the face enough to do a sketch of it. And then it kind of took them down that road. Because yeah. Had they not done that, there's no way it would have been found out.
No, probably not.
Wow.
But Joy had not been reported missing until October 5th. almost 2 weeks after her last communication.
Okay.
Now, what was strange was that someone was already sitting in the San Diego County Jail for confessing to the murder of Joy Risker. Only this person had still not been formally charged with her disappearance because there was no body, but there was a confession.
But then how can they be held?
Because there was enough evidence to hold them in her disappearance and possible murder, and there was a confession.
Okay.
But they hadn't been formally charged yet because they were still trying to make a case.
Gotcha.
Even okay. Without a body.
All right.
But now they had a body.
Okay.
Which, thank goodness.
Wow. All right.
Well, Joy Lynn Risker was the only child of Charles and Gwendolyn Risker. Her family relocated to San Diego from Detroit, Michigan in 1985. Joy was 7 at the time. But only 2 years later, Charles Risker moved back to Detroit, and he and Gwen divorced. Joy and her mom remained in San Diego County, and Joy had little contact with her father after that. Joy was very close with her mom, but struggled with the loss of her father, which led her to searching for sort of a father figure.
Mm.
As Joy grew up, she became very close with a group of friends that she made in high school. Joy was only a year older than me. She was born in 1978, and I'm born in 1979, and I grew up in San Diego County. So our lives very much paralleled each other during this time. She loved to hang out with her friends, obviously, like I did, and they'd party and go to raves most every weekend, which
raves
is kind of what I did.
You went to a rave?
I've been to quite a few raves.
I don't even know what that means.
My favorite rave was actually in an abandoned airplane hangar.
Seriously?
I swear.
You went to a rave in an airplane hangar?
Yes.
Look at you.
I know. And I can just imagine Joy taking the trolley down to Chula Vista and walking to Tijuana.
Sure.
and Revolution Street. So I feel very kind of connected to Joy at this point because I feel like our lives were probably very similar at this time.
Yeah. Maybe mm-hmm. She was in that airplane hangar with you.
Maybe.
With your cocaine and ecstasy.
No, wasn't cocaine. Oh. She sounded like she was a lot of fun too.
Yeah.
And just a really sweet girl and just really loved everybody and just really had a lot of fun during that time. That was an easy time, I'll have to say. You know, the 90s.
Sure.
In that time period, like 95 to 2000, that was a really fun time.
Yeah.
All right. Enough about me. Let's get back to Joy.
That's when there was still hope.
There was. Now the hope is depleted. So Joy and her friends, they were not bad kids at all, but there was a little bit of a lack of direction.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I totally was there. Around 1993, Joy's mom started attending a local evangelical church. Gwen became friendly with an assistant youth pastor, 26-year-old Sean Goff. He was magnetic, charismatic, and could preach. This guy could preach. I actually listened to some little sound bites of him preaching, and he was definitely one of those, you know, talk with my hands and the inflection in my voice and very,
very, very grand.
Very grand. Like, uh-huh. You could definitely pay attention to him.
You wouldn't fall asleep.
No. And he knew his theology very well. He lived and breathed theology.
Okay.
It seems like.
Yeah.
Sean and his wife, 20-year-old Sheila Goff, had recently moved to the San Diego area. Sean and Sheila were married in 1990. Sean was 24 and Sheila was 17. The couple had met at a church in Oklahoma City when Sheila was 15 years old. Sean was her youth pastor.
Okay. It's not weird at all.
Gwen.
Maybe a little bit.
Joy's mom liked Sean immediately and asked him to help her with 16-year-old Joy, kind of take her under his wing and be the adult male figure that Joy needed at that time. Joy eventually relented and began attending church regularly with her mom, Gwen, and soon joined the youth group under the leadership of Sean Goff. The two hit it off right away, and soon Joy seemed to be on the straight and narrow, following God's word and becoming a devoted member of the ministry, but still remaining close to her group of friends. According to court documents, in 1996, Sean and then 18-year-old Joy became sexually intimate for the first time.
Yep.
You saw where that was going, right?
Yeah, I could see that. He's obviously attracted to the youngins.
He likes the young girls.
He likes the young girls.
While Sheila was pregnant with their son, with their first child.
Boy.
After the birth, Sean approached Sheila with an idea. They should enter into a Christian polygamous relationship with Joy.
Of course they should.
Sheila refused to entertain the idea at first, but then Sean sort of persuaded her into it, using Moses and Abraham and David and, you know, biblical figures from the Bible as examples of God-fearing men who had hundreds of wives. Now, the only one that had hundreds of wives was King Solomon, but
I can't even convince
what they said
you
in court documents
to go back out and try and have a crack at relearning to drive stick. And he's able to talk his wife into bringing in a second young hot thing. And I don't know. I don't get it. Guys are just skilled, I guess.
Sean was very manipulative, and he very much controlled the relationship and the marriage with Sheila.
Could I ever succeed in convincing you to bring on a second wife?
No. And why would you ever want to? I am all the drama that you need, sir.
I don't know.
How crazy do I make your life?
It sounds like a nightmare.
That is a nightmare.
Oh, God.
No, I am too jealous to even comprehend that idea. I would literally lose my mind if you ever tried to get me to do that.
Hmm.
All right.
Good times.
Yeah.
All right. Well, now that we've made it uncomfortable in the room,
I know.
Let's proceed.
Plus, Sean had also threatened to leave Sheila and take their son with him if she did not agree to this Christian polygamy idea.
You know, they have lawyers, right? They're called divorce attorneys.
But
that would never happen.
Sheila was very much committed to her husband, and he was the head of the household.
All right.
In August of 1997, a spiritual ceremony was performed by a polygamist minister from southern Utah, formalizing 30-year-old Sean and 19-year-old Joy's union. So there we go.
Is it like Big Love with Bill Paxton?
No, not at all.
All right.
That show, I love that show.
That's the only thing I can imagine.
The last two seasons were dumb.
It's hard to not think about lines from Twister, though, when I watch that.
Oh, boy. All right. Well, just to reiterate, Sean is not a fundamentalist Mormon.
So he's just a what would be considered a non-denominational Christian.
No, they were calling him a fundamentalist Christian.
Okay.
Just like people who practice polygamy consider themselves fundamentalist Mormons.
Even though there's no fundamentals of Christianity that include being a polygamist, so I don't know.
Not anymore.
I don't know where that came from.
But people like to pick and choose scripture from the Bible that fits within the polygamist realm,
right?
Or Christian polygamy. Actually, we were going to have our son come on and explain Christian polygamy as a 16-year-old,
right? Because that, you know, seems
because
like
that seems really important.
Because he's basically an expert.
He kind of is when it comes to Bible theology. It's very interesting to him.
Because he's currently attending seminary. Nope, he's not. That would be weird.
Right. I was asking him questions, and he knew the answers to my questions, and he could tell you who had multiple wives and why they had wives, and, you know, some wives were barren, so they took another wife. It's kind of all of these things.
Sure.
Now we are becoming a polygamist podcast, I guess.
Sounds like it.
Okay. Now, after the ceremony, Joy moved into the home with Sean and Sheila and began their lives as a Christian polygamist family. This was done in secret. Now, Gwen, Joy's mom, did know about the marriage to Sean and her choice to become a sister wife to Sheila. Gwen did not approve of this at first, but eventually came around and supported her daughter's decision. I think Gwen really liked Sean, and that was actually a problem.
Okay, so real quick to recap, because I have short-term memory loss.
Okay.
And attention span of a gnat. What year was this, approximately?
1997.
97. Okay, I was graduating from high school. And he is a pastor, co-pastor, head pastor? What?
He's a youth pastor.
Youth pastor at a church in San Diego.
At an evangelical church.
In San Diego County.
Somewhere. Yes, and I could not for the life of me figure out which church this was.
No,
it
that's
is
fine.
Kept very, very secret.
Yeah, that's fine. No, I was just trying to recap for anyone who forgets things like me.
And some churches change their name on a regular basis.
Possibly for a lot of reasons. Okay, fair enough. All right, 97, gotcha. Church, San Diego County, perfect. Youth pastor.
Think Mission Valley area. Think the bowl.
Yeah, all right.
Okay.
That's fine. I did.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Think of IKEA, Dave and Buster's.
Yeah.
Qualcomm Stadium, Jack Murphy Field,
right next
which
to
is
the,
not at all what it is anymore.
Right next to the 8 going east, eastbound.
Beautiful.
Interstate 8.
Beautiful area.
By UC San Diego.
No, SDSU.
Right by SDSU.
It was my little stomping ground. A month later, so a month after the wedding, an email was sent to a church co-worker of Sean's. Sean had accidentally copied and pasted another message to this email. It was a thank you email to the minister who had spiritually married Sean and Joy, telling him how grateful Sean was. The co-worker confronted Sean about this email, which Sean denied at first until the co-worker read out loud the email to Sean. No, look, this is what you sent me. This is what you copied and pasted. Sean then admitted that he had married Joy.
Okay.
Spiritually.
So he took a risk, though, because the church he is the youth pastor for would certainly frown on him doing that. Probably kick him out of his job. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
His coworker told Sean that Sean knew it was wrong because he was keeping it a secret and it violated the church's doctrine.
Okay.
And it's illegal in the United States. So he's telling Sean, dude, you knew this was wrong because you were keeping this a secret.
Right.
So that's interesting.
It is. I don't understand why he would want to do that other than it's exciting to him to try and live a secret life. If you really want to do that, why don't you move to a town that is officially, unofficially a polygamous town in, say, Colorado City?
But that's Mormon.
Oh, sorry.
That's a Mormon.
Okay.
A fundamentalist Mormon
community.
Yeah. That's not a fundamentalist Christian community.
He couldn't just go.
No. Well, Sean refused to discontinue his lifestyle, and then he's let go from his job and position at the church. Because then everybody found out about it.
So now what is he going to do? He has two women, two wives, one official, one unofficial, and they're...
A kid.
Were they working?
Joy was.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Sean, Sheila, Joy, and the baby moved to Vallejo to start over. But after the birth of Sean and Joy's son in early 2000, the family moved back to San Diego County and into a home in the Kensington area. I've never heard of the Kensington area of San Diego County.
Me neither.
Never heard of it before. So the day after Sean and Joy's son was born, Gwen, Joy's mom, died tragically the day after her grandson was born. Isn't that sad?
Okay, so Sean and Joy made a baby too.
They made a baby together.
Goodness, okay.
And that baby was born in 2000, and then they moved back to San Diego.
So it wasn't just a spiritual relationship. It was...
No, they were...
Let's get physical. Yeah. Physical.
And in 2002, Joy gave birth to her second son. So Sheila and Sean have one son. Joy and Sean have two sons.
So it seems like Joy and Sean
enjoyed each
were
other.
More busy than Sheila and Sean. Would that bother you?
Absolutely.
If the second wife and I were twice as...
Joy was kind of referred to as the fun public wife.
Ah.
And Sheila was the stay-at-home mom.
Okay.
Kind of sweet wife.
Okay.
Joy was shown off a little bit more.
Okay.
Now, up to that time, up to 2002, Joy worked outside of the home and Sheila stayed home with the kids. But once the second baby was born, I believe they were both home for a little while.
Kind of a question.
What?
How do people afford to do this?
I don't know.
Everything I do every day, I just, you can correct me if I'm wrong. I come home and I look at you and I go, how the hell are people affording to do this?
I don't know.
Right?
Mm. Well, that's my answer is I don't know. I have no idea. But Sean took a job working in marketing for an online computer related publishing company.
Sure.
So that was his job. I have no idea what that was called. Now, by 2003, friends of Joy's begin to notice that she is a bit restless and does not seem happy with her marital agreement.
She's
Joy like, wanted more.
She's like, what, 22?
She's 24.
So, 24.
23, I'm 24.
Not a mathematician, obviously. Okay, so she's still young and spry.
Right.
Not like us. Old, decrepit, wheelchair-bound, oxygen tubes.
She's married spiritually, has a sister wife. There's three little boys.
She's cute.
She's very cute. She's very cute.
She's adorable.
And she's starting to realize that maybe this isn't exactly what she wants in life. So she's kind of questioning things at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Joy wanted more freedom, more control over her own life. And Joy now wants a career. She wanted to be a makeup artist, which is so cool.
That's what I want to do when I grow up.
I don't know if you could be, but I could be. That's what I want to do. Joy, that's what I want to do too.
I offer to our daughter all the time. I'm like, did you want me to do your makeup for you? And she goes,
no.
No. Fine.
On October 5th, 2003, a friend of Joy's walked into a San Diego police station and reported their friend missing, saying that Joy had been communicating with multiple friends through email exchanges, but that no one had actually spoken directly with Joy in weeks. The email stated that Joy had left for Europe with an ex-boyfriend from Boston.
What?
When she was asked to please call someone because they were all concerned, she answered back that she did not want to talk to any of them and to mind their own business. She did not have to answer their questions and that they should stop bothering her. Now, I'm compiling a bunch of emails into each other. I'm just giving everyone the gist of what was said in those emails.
Now, I get that you're just reading what was allegedly what was said, but if she was a child, essentially, in my opinion, somewhat groomed, when did she have an ex-boyfriend from Boston? Was she 12?
Exactly. She had
She went to Europe
she had
with
a
an ex-boyfriend from Boston? Okay.
No, I know. I'll get there. I promise I'll get there.
Okay.
Now, the friends knew that this was not at all how Joy would correspond with them.
Okay.
She would never have said things like that. She would never have written things like that. And she would call and talk to her friends no matter what was going on in her life. If they said, I need to talk to you, I need to hear your voice, she would have called back right away.
Yeah.
100%. And plus, if Joy was in Europe, how? Because she didn't have a passport. How does one get to Europe without a passport?
And it takes a couple of bucks to get to Europe and run around in circles and such.
Even backpacking, it takes a few dollars to do that.
Yeah.
Now, some friends were able to make contact with Sean. He told them that, yes, Joy had left him and the children to run around Europe with a guy and that she had taken $5,000 from their joint checking account.
He had $5,000 extra, considering all the stuff they're trying to stay afloat in San Diego County.
Yes.
That's pretty impressive.
I don't exactly know what their finances were. I don't know if they were being helped by any part of the family. I don't know. Now, to them, Sean did not seem concerned about his second wife. This was enough for the group of friends to want to file the missing persons report. They just...
Something was off.
Something was wrong. Now, a police officer was sent to Joy's residence and spoke to Sean. Sean said that he was the father of Joy's children and that she had left with a man named Jason, but he did not know where they had gone. Sean said that Joy was neither missing or in danger. She had left of her own free will. The officer believed Sean and left the residence, but did prepare a report and submitted it to a missing persons investigator at the San Diego Police Department. A Linda Kuzin, a missing persons investigative aide with the San Diego Police Department, and she received the report. That is the job that I want. I want to be a missing persons investigative aide.
You should apply right now.
I should.
Yep.
I love helping people who are one step above me. Yeah. I don't want to be that one step above. Yeah. I want to help from behind the scenes.
Well, you certainly don't want to help someone who's one step below you.
No. I want to help the person above me. So sure. I want to be an aide. I want to be an investigative aide.
You should be.
I should be.
Think of the stories.
Seriously.
That you couldn't tell.
After contacting Joy's friends, Linda Kuzin was told about the couple's strained relationship and the times they saw Sean acting aggressively toward Joy. That Joy was no longer happy and was thinking about taking the children and starting a new life without Sean. Linda read the strange and concerning email exchanges from Joy, and she knew that there was something wrong. From the way that their friends were explaining who Joy was, she could tell in those emails that that was not Joy. Linda telephoned Sean on October 8th and told him she was investigating Joy's missing persons report. Sean told her that Joy had sent him an email telling him that she was going to Europe and that she had withdrawn money from their account the previous day. He had already told her friends that she had withdrawn $5,000 before the missing persons report was even filed. And now he's telling Linda that she had removed that money from their account the day before. So now his lies and his time is all off.
Gotcha.
Sean told Linda that Joy was not happy and was not the motherly type. She was not satisfied just staying home and taking care of the children. Linda asked Sean to forward her any emails that Joy had sent him, and he did. And they were basically the same thing. Like, I'm going to Europe with Jason. I don't know when I'll be back. I just need time away. I'm not happy anymore kind of stuff.
She emailed him that stuff?
She emailed him that.
Allegedly?
Allegedly.
Interesting.
Now, the man mentioned in the email... His name was Jason, obviously, was contacted, and he said that he had not heard from Joy in months. They had been friends previously, but they never really dated, and he hadn't heard from her in a long time, and there were no plans for them to ever meet up or see each other or anything.
So Jason is a real person.
Jason is a real person.
Okay.
But he was not a person that Joy would have ran off with.
Gotcha.
On October 21st, Sean was asked to fax over Joy's cell phone bill. It showed that Joy's last call was made to Sean at 9:36 p.m. on September 19th, 2003. When asked about the call, Sean said that they had gotten into an argument and Sean had left the house. Joy called him and asked him to please come back home, and he did. The two went to bed without resolving the issue, and then early the next morning, so September 20th, he woke up and he heard a noise. He looked out the window and saw Joy with two silver-colored suitcases being loaded into a tan Lexus SUV. Joy got into the passenger seat, and the vehicle drove off. He did not know anyone who owned that kind of car.
So he's claiming that he...
He now saw her leave.
Slept through all that noise?
He slept through her packing.
Yeah.
And then woke up to see her getting into a tan Lexus SUV.
And that was it.
That was it. That was the last time you saw her.
Nope. I don't buy it.
And then Linda asked Sean why he had never told her this before.
Yeah.
And seems he like didn't really have an answer.
Somewhat useful information to divulge.
Right. Because this was the second, I think this was the second or third time that Linda had actually talked to Sean. And this was the first time he was telling her this. And then Sean then tells Linda about the polygamous lifestyle, that there's another wife, his first wife, Sheila.
So she didn't realize.
She didn't know. And which I'm a little confused about that, because I know that Joy's friends knew, but why wouldn't Joy's friends tell Linda?
How could anyone not know
what was going on?
What was going on? I mean, it's not like they lived out in the middle of nowhere.
Right.
They lived in a very busy-ish area. You're talking Southern California. It's not like they live in the outskirts of Texas or something.
And Joy and Sean would go to parties and get-togethers and weddings of her friends. They knew they were a couple, but maybe they didn't know about Sheila. I'm trying to think, because 90% of my information came from the appeal records and the court documents, and I'll tell you why at the end. And so in reading that, I never understood why they didn't tell Linda about the relationship.
Mm-hmm. Seems like that would be
important. I was a little confused about that. I know I would have as a friend. That's probably the first thing I would have said, just because it is so interesting to me. But maybe to them, it was just normal. Like, yeah, Joy's husband who's married to somebody else. Okay, well, now Sheila became a person of interest because she's the other woman.
Sure.
Linda went to her work and questioned Sheila about Joy. And Sheila was shocked. She had no idea that any of this was going on or that Joy was even considered a missing person. She had no idea that Sean was being questioned by the police about Joy.
But Joy was no longer living with them.
Yeah, because Sean had told her that she had left them.
Oh, and she probably secretly was happy about that.
No, according to everybody that really talked about Sheila, Sheila really loved Joy. She really kind of took on that sisterly relationship with Joy and loved the boys. So Joy's gone, and she thinks Joy just left them all, and Sheila's still taking care of the boys. Sheila told Linda that Joy had just kind of up and left them, because that's what Sean was saying. And that when she returned from a weekend away with the kids, Joy was gone. And she had no idea what had happened and where Joy was. And they said they could honestly see in her face that she had no idea what was going on. Yeah,
she believed that.
Mm-hmm. But then, are you ready for this?
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yes, ready.
Later that same evening, so a few hours after Sheila had been questioned by Linda, Sean Goff entered the visitor's lobby of the county jail in downtown San Diego. He walked up to the deputy on duty and told him that he had killed someone and wanted to turn himself in. The deputy asked who he had killed, and Sean answered, Joy Risker, and telling the deputy that Joy was listed as a missing person and that Linda Kuzin was investigating the case. Sean was detained and then transported to police headquarters for further investigation by the homicide unit. Sean was led into an interrogation room and interviewed by a homicide detective. After being advised of his Miranda rights and stating that he understood each of those rights, Sean confessed to the killing of Joy Risker. Not the murder of Joy, but to the killing of Joy.
Oh, okay.
Telling the investigator that he could no longer keep up the charade, misleading investigators and everyone who was concerned about Joy.
This ought to be interesting.
It was. He was not sleeping. He was not eating. He had lost like 25 pounds in a couple weeks. He was just not able to function keeping this up. But Sean would not be telling them how he had killed Joy or why. And Sean would definitely not be telling them where he had taken her body. He was controlling the situation. This was an admission and not exactly a confession. So he was admitting to killing her, but he was not confessing the entire story.
Gotcha.
Sean told the investigator about the nature of their relationship, that he was legally married to a woman named Sheila and spiritually married to Joy, saying that he and Joy were incompatible and had been talking about splitting up. After a series of more questions that Sean would not answer, he finally asked for a lawyer. So he finally lawyered up. Sean could not be formally charged with Joy's murder, but they could arrest him and hold him for 3 days, giving investigators 72 hours to gather enough evidence to present to the district attorney in order to charge Sean with the murder. With no body, no crime scene, and no witness, investigators knew they needed to start by searching the home Sean shared with his two wives and their three young boys, which Sean gave them permission to do. Sheila answered the door of the Spanish-style house. She had been told by Sean that police would be at the door later that night. So before he left, he said, "I'm leaving and police will be here soon."
And she didn't ask why?
She never asked him why. This was the basis of their marriage.
Interesting.
Sean tells you what to do and you don't question it.
All right.
She told the investigators that the weekend Joy disappeared, she had taken the three boys to Santa Barbara for the weekend so Sean and Joy could spend a couple days alone at home. She produced receipts to prove that she had been in Santa Barbara from the 19th of September to the 21st.
Okay.
The last time she had talked to Joy was when Joy had called around 8:30 p.m. on the 19th to say goodnight to the boys.
Hmm.
Now, while driving home on the 21st, Sheila received a call from Sean telling her that Joy had left the family. He also informed Sheila that Joy had cut herself in the bathroom because he had told Joy that he was going to take the children and leave her and fight for custody. Sean had taken Joy to the hospital for medical attention. So he's saying basically that Joy tried to kill herself.
Okay.
Is what I'm gathering from that. He told Sheila that there was blood around the house and that she needed to clean it up so the boys would not be upset, so that the boys would not see it. Sheila arrived home and noticed immediately that all the blinds were closed, which was unusual. And Sheila, being the dutiful wife and never allowed to question Sean, she started cleaning up. Sheila noticed that the sheets had been removed from Joy's bed. An area rug that had been lying in between the bed and the baby's crib was gone, and a rug from the hallway had been cleaned and was in the dryer. There was blood in Joy's bathroom, on the south rear wall, and on the shower curtain. Sheila also cleaned blood that she had found on Joy's bed, the mattress, and a blanket. So she just
this
went...
This is a lot.
Yeah.
And she didn't ask.
She never asked.
Because what? She was afraid he would do something?
I think she was afraid of Sean. Yes.
Okay.
She was a
and she was younger,
dutiful wife.
Much younger than him.
She was 7 years younger than Sean. Yeah. And Joy was 11 years younger than Sean. Sean did not arrive home till the next day, telling Sheila that he had taken a drive to clear his head and work through the grief of the breakup. Now, Sean was driving a Dodge Durango that he had rented specifically for that weekend. He had rented it the morning that Sheila was taking the boys to Santa Barbara. He had told Sheila that he had rented it for his romantic weekend with Joy since Joy loved SUVs. And they chose a Dodge Durango.
All right. I mean,
a Tahoe. I can see a Tahoe.
She likes SUVs. Okay. I mean,
I would have gone with like an old sports car.
It's an odd thing to love.
Well, it's an odd thing to love SUVs, but then to pick a Dodge Durango out of every SUV that you could rent.
Okay. If I'm going to go, if I'm going on a road trip, Tahoe, Suburban, something, Toyota Sequoia all day long over a Honda Civic, right?
Right.
Something you can stretch your legs in.
Yeah.
Something with plush leather, you know, something comfortable.
Okay, but would you choose a Dodge Durango out of all those other ones?
Probably not.
You owned a Dodge Durango at one point.
Yeah, but Whatever. Okay, fine. She loves SUVs. Great.
Now, it was due back later that day, so Sean asked Sheila to help him clean it out. The interior of the Durango was a mess. Like, there was dirt and rocks and dirt clods were found throughout the back of the Durango.
Wow. This will make you want to buy a previous rental, probably, I'm guessing.
My car is a rental return.
I think it was, yeah.
No, it is. They told us when we bought it 10 years ago. Was it?
Yeah.
It was a rental return.
Not a lease?
No, it was a rental return. It had only been...
It was only a year old.
It was only a year old, yeah. But remember, the back is kind of scratched up, and that's from luggage and stuff?
Probably, yeah.
Okay, anyways, enough about ourselves.
So the rental, he brought it back, and it's filthy. Obviously, had something happen.
Right, and there were gas cans. There were empty gas cans in the back as well. But that was it. Sheila noticed scratch marks up and down Sean's arms, as though he had been walking through dense trees and bushes. His clothing was dirty and torn, and he threw them away along with his shoes. While interviewing Sheila, officers began processing the home. Sean's computer was taken, along with bills, receipts, and just random documents that were lying around. Blood was found on the leg of the crib in Joy's bedroom, along with blood found on the floor, walls, an entertainment system, and a small credenza. Bloodstains were also found in the master bathroom, on the walls, the door jamb, and the west side of the bathtub. Now, this is just what they could see with the naked eye, which means Sheila didn't clean it up as well as she...
As well as Sean had hoped she would have.
Right. But I think that she couldn't see it.
Right.
And obviously, Sean couldn't see it. So we're talking little tiny blood drops.
Mm. But these are trained investigators. Exactly. So they know what to look for.
Exactly.
Plus, they got all magic CSI stuff.
Well, this was just what they could see with the naked eye. But when luminol was sprayed, especially in the bathroom, it lit up like a freaking Christmas tree, like a pregnancy test. Blood was everywhere.
Like a pregnancy on Christmas.
Now, this was an intense and violent attack.
Real quick, I have to interrupt you.
What? Someone's going to be mad.
Crime scene luminol, powdered. $16. Amazon. It'll be here Tuesday.
Did you just order it?
No.
You better not. But don't order it. I don't want to see how dirty Amazon. Our house is.
So that's not bad.
That's not too bad.
Okay. You're welcome.
Well, the blood was analyzed and it was Joy's. All of that was Joy's.
So it was everywhere.
Everywhere. According to a bloodstain analyst, it appeared as though only one person had the upper hand. So this was not a fight. She was just chased and stabbed and murdered.
So that's why it's all over.
That's why it's everywhere. Now, the initial attack happened in the bedroom, and there was a chase, which ultimately ended in the bathroom, where they believed Joy was murdered and disfigured. Sean had returned the car to an Enterprise rent-a-car on the 23rd. And according to their records, the odometer showed he had driven it over 1,200 miles.
Wowzers.
That's a lot. So from Mission Valley, from the Mission Valley area of San Diego, to the area that Joy was found is approximately 300 miles. So it's really 4 hours with no traffic and no stops.
Okay.
Is kind of what I figured.
Yeah.
Now, Gila Bend is an hour and a half past Yuma, and it's 76 miles from where Highway 8 ends and becomes Interstate 10.
Mm-hmm.
So you know the area that I'm talking about. There's like nothing out there.
Yeah, it's southwest-ish of Phoenix, kind of.
Yes.
Yeah.
And just a few miles from the border.
Mm-hmm.
For those of you that don't live in Southern California or in Southern Arizona, I mean, you really don't care. You can't picture it, but we do have a lot of family members and people who listen in Southern California. So I really just wanted to kind of tell them where this area is.
Right.
Sean's computer was analyzed, and it was revealed that the emails he and Joy's friends had received after Joy's disappearance had originated from Sean's computer. So yeah. He was the one writing those emails. Yeah,
we kind of all figured that out.
I know. It's obvious. Mm-hmm. You guys are so smart.
So smart.
A receipt was found from a Lowe's home improvement store in the Mission Valley area. Sean had purchased a shovel, a pickaxe, a hacksaw, a 3-inch tow chain, a chisel, a sledgehammer, 75 feet of rope, and 2 padlocks. All
outing?
On the same receipt. Yes.
Well, that's kind of stupid.
That same day, Sean purchased a large cooler, a pair of gloves, 5-gallon paint buckets. I think there were 2 of them. 2 rolls of 250 square feet of plastic sheeting, 55 yards of duct tape, an 8-inch butcher knife, a cutting board, and a 6-foot step ladder from the local Walmart.
How did they get receipts? He kept them?
Yeah, he kept all the receipts, and they did a credit card statement.
Okay.
Search
so
or whatever.
For those of you wondering how to get away with things, A, use cash, and D, just spread the purchases around a little bit. Don't do it all at once. That seems kind of obvious.
Yeah, there was probably another Lowe's or Home Depot 2 miles away.
See, all those things you've listed, I have, but I've been collecting them over a long period of time so as to not arouse suspicion.
Arouse. I'm just joking.
Right, arouse.
When asked about these purchases, Sean said that the items were purchased to do some gardening and home repairs around the house. But according to Sheila, Sean was not at all handy, nor did he enjoy gardening. And the home was a rental. Gardening services were included in the rent.
Yeah.
Okay, so
if I rented, it would be the last thing I'd want to do is yard work.
And you wouldn't need all those items, and you wouldn't be painting. You wouldn't be doing anything like that in the home. That's up to the...
Not really, no.
That's up to the landlord.
It depends. Yeah, I mean, it depends what kind of relationship you have with them. Maybe you're a long-term renter. You know, you might throw a few bucks at it just because you have to live in it.
Right, but they hadn't been living in it for very long.
No, normally,
and when talking to the landlord, he said, well, no, my gardener comes over here and does the lawn, and they would fix whatever needed to be fixed within the rental. So yeah, there was no need for him to have any of that
stuff.
Yeah,
and it's not like it's a 2-acre property, which has a lot of maintenance and stuff like that.
Right.
So,
but you'll see why Sean is saying, oh, no, I bought all that stuff for the house.
Sure.
Joy's cell phone records were analyzed as well. And like we had said before, her last outgoing call was to Sean's cell phone on September 19th at 9:36 p.m. or 9:34 p.m. It depends on what, depends on your sources, 9:36, 9:34. I guess it doesn't matter.
Yeah, sometime in the evening.
Sometime after 9:30.
Perfect.
There were no more exchanges after that. The phone went dead. Now having Joy's body and having all of the evidence that they had gathered to keep him in jail, they could formally charge Sean with Joy's murder.
Gotcha.
In the summer of 2006, Sean went on trial for Joy's murder. Sean took the stand in his own defense. He said that in late 2002 and early 2003, Joy was unhappy and looking for more freedom. She wanted to attend a makeup school in Burbank. Sean did not think it was a good idea since that meant she would be gone during the week, away from the boys. The relationship was strained. The weekend of the 19th, the family were all supposed to go to Santa Barbara, but Sean decided he and Joy should stay home and try to rekindle the spark between them or plan their breakup.
Mm-hmm. It's very black and white.
Sean wanted to show Joy that they could still have a good relationship and a good time together.
Mm-hmm.
But my question is, why wouldn't they go to Santa Barbara to try to rekindle the relationship and then Sheila and the boys stay home?
That's a great point.
That seems like that would have been not only easier, but that would have been more romantic. Get away from your normal everyday situation.
Yeah, we don't stay home and send the kids away. We keep the kids home and send us away.
Right. That's how we rekindle our relationship.
Yeah, they know how to use a microwave.
If that did not work, he was going to ask Joy to leave. Now, he's saying this up on the stand. Now, Joy did like SUVs, so he rented one for that weekend. Sean took Joy out to a very fancy dinner at the Hotel Del Coronado, spending almost $300.
How the hell does he have all this money?
I guess he had a good job.
Okay.
So my second question is, this is 2003. If you're going to spend $300 at the Hotel Del and you're going to drive all the way there, why don't you just get a room and stay the night? Just saying.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know.
Because that was not part of his plan. I think there was a plan.
Ah.
Yes. At dinner, Joy brought up the idea of going back to school to become a makeup artist. She had a whole plan, which included staying in the Burbank area during the weekdays to be closer to the school. Joy was adamant about her plan and wanted to discuss it further. At home, the two began to argue since Sean finally told Joy that he did not want her to attend the school at all. He didn't want her to go to school. They got in an argument, a heated argument, and Sean left the house to take a walk because he did not want to have a shouting match with Joy. As he was walking, Joy called his cell phone and told him that she had calmed down and would he please come back so they could work it out. Sean said he did return because he was going to ask Joy to leave, telling her that this was not going to work. Joy told him that he was not going to take the kids away from her, and he responded with, "You are not going to worry about the kids anymore because I have photos of bruises you caused on the youngest son." So then Sean says he walked to his computer and pulled out Polaroids of bruises that he had found on his youngest son and taken photos of. And he had been hiding those pictures under his keyboard.
That wouldn't have worked, but okay.
And he threw the pile of pictures on Joy's bed. Joy came back into the room holding a butcher's knife and screamed at Sean, "You son of a bitch, I will kill you," and came after him with the knife.
Mm.
So now it's, you know, it's Joy's fault.
Sure.
Sean punched her twice and Joy fell back, but then came after him again with the knife. They struggled for the weapon. Sean grabbed Joy's arm and pushed the knife into her. So it sounds like she's holding the knife and he was able to push it into her while she's holding the knife.
And she didn't let go of the knife while he's pushing it into her.
Right. Still struggling, he pulled the knife out and then stabbed Joy again in the left shoulder. And then Joy fell limp onto the bed. So that explains the blood on the bed. According to Sean, she did have a pulse but was not breathing. So he pulled her down onto the floor and began CPR. At least he knew to pull her onto the floor. We have had cases where they've tried to resuscitate their loved one on their bed and not pull them onto the floor.
Well, I placed her on a stack of soft pillows and then proceeded to perform CPR.
So he knew that much, I guess.
But then he just purposely stabbed her. Now he's trying to perform CPR.
Well, he stabbed her in self-defense.
Why not just take the knife away? Why not just put...
Well, I mean, we're logically thinking here, but... All right.
Fine. I won't think logically.
So he began CPR. He removed the knife from her shoulder and blood began pouring out of the wound.
Uh-huh.
Sean vomited in a trash can and then thought about calling 911, but knew that the police would never believe that a man had killed a woman in self-defense and did not want the boys to be without a mother and a father, deciding the only thing he could do was cover up the killing. He moved her body to the bathroom, cut off the tips of her fingers with a meat cleaver from the kitchen, removed her teeth with a saw from a toolbox in the garage, retrieved a large 5-foot-long plastic storage container from the garage that they had already had. Remember, because this isn't premeditated, this was just self-defense. Placed her body inside and dragged it out to the garage. He loaded the storage container into the back of the SUV that he had rented. And then he cleaned up. He cleaned up as good as he could, he says. At sunrise, Sean drove north on Interstate 15 till he hit the 8 East. Having no idea where he was going, he just drove.
Okay.
Just kept going. But he did have gas cans in the back of the rented SUV.
in case he drove off the highway for some length of time, distance, where there wouldn't be gas stations. Okay.
Along the drive, he realized he had not done a good job of cleaning up the mess, so he called Sheila and lied to her about the blood, asking her to clean it up when she got home, telling her that Joy had cut herself. Now, Sean ended up in Arizona, and he took the Agua Caliente Road exit and drove till he saw the big Palo Verde tree. He removed Joy's body from the container, placed it on the ground in a fetal position. Actually, I think she was already in a fetal position because he had put her in that container. And he began stacking lava rocks around her and then on top of her. He then realized that she could still be identified by her facial features. This makes me sick. So he grabbed a rock and bashed her face in. The woman that he loved, he says.
So he's claiming that he threw up from the knife going into her shoulder.
And the blood.
But he was able to chop her fingers off with a meat cleaver, remove parts of her jaw, and
remove the teeth.
And then as a final act, bash her face in so she can't be recognized.
And he almost decapitated her.
He attempted to decapitate her,
which a lot of people
we've heard in
forget
the past
about.
That's mm-hmm. very difficult to do.
It's very difficult.
Okay. All right, sure. Uh-huh.
Yeah, Sean.
Yeah, he's
totally believable.
It seems like something.
He continued stacking the rocks on top of her after bashing her face in.
Mm-hmm.
And he built a little tower of smaller rocks on top as a show of respect. Quote unquote respect.
Okay.
This guy.
What's the point?
What's the point to all of this?
To what? To come visit her? To bring other people there to show?
Like a monument to her.
Okay. Sure.
Ugh. Gross. He then retrieved a towel containing her jaw and her fingertips from the bin. He walked 5 minutes into the desert and buried them. He then turned around and drove back to San Diego. He also testified that he did continue to cover up what he did, answering the email sent by Joy's friends, but that he was panic-stricken the entire time and that he could not eat or sleep. After much praying, he decided to turn himself in. When asked about the purchases made at Lowe's and Walmart before Joy's death, I believe it was 5 days before Joy's death, Sean said that those items were bought for projects around the house, not a kill kit. They were calling this his kill kit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, found during the search of the house was everything on the receipts, except for the new shovel, pickaxe, and sledgehammer. But his own father testified that when he had come to San Diego to move Sheila and the boys back to Arkansas, he found the new shovel, pickaxe, and sledgehammer in the garage and loaded them into his trailer and took them back with him. So that's why those items weren't in the garage.
Okay.
Which means those items could have been the ones that were used to mutilate Joy.
Yeah.
Because we're looking at a shovel, a pickaxe, and a sledgehammer. And when analyzing the bones of Joy's face, there were little grooves in her bones that matched what is around a sledgehammer. There's like little grooves, almost like a comb.
Okay.
If you've ever noticed, I've never noticed. So they are saying that he bashed her face in. That sounds so cruel.
Because it is cruel.
No, you're right. That he did that to her face with a sledgehammer and not a rock. Because he wants people to think that this was not premeditated, that he did not buy those items to kill Joy, that he killed her in self-defense and then mutilated her as kind of a last resort. Not that he had planned to do that.
It's weird, though, that you would plan to mutilate someone. Wouldn't you want them to just disappear without any trace?
True, and I might have the answer for you towards the end.
Okay.
All right.
I'm just saying, personally, it sounds like you wouldn't want
all of this trace evidence, because assuming he would want to get away with it, although supposedly he had a change of heart and then felt bad and confessed.
And in prayer, God said you in should prayer. Confess.
Okay.
Yes. Now, the state painted a sort of different picture of Sean in the months and weeks leading up to Joy's disappearance, that he had planned the murder of Joy because he wanted complete control over her life. Sean was dissatisfied with Joy, and if the two were to ever split, she would never see the kids again. Hmm. That's what he always told her, and that's what he told Sheila, that okay. if they ever left him, they would never see the kids again. Sean even told a friend that Joy was the kind of person who would take off and leave, never looking back. The type that would run off with an old boyfriend and leave her kids behind. So he was building a story to explain Joy's absence before she was even gone. He was telling people this.
Hmm.
So he was building up a story to go along with Joy's disappearance.
Yeah.
Almost, so this is premeditated.
Yeah, like he was planning on getting rid of her. But why not just encourage her to go if you're tired of her?
I don't know. Why don't people just let other people go?
Why would you want her gone and not have her take care of her own kids?
And be a mom. She was a wonderful mom, is what everybody said, even Sheila.
Yeah.
She was a wonderful and loving person.
Not want her to have custody of her kids.
At least contact with the children.
Yeah.
Because Sean was controlling. And she wanted to leave him. And how dare she want to leave Sean?
So you're saying he didn't want her to leave. He's saying that he...
Yeah, he wanted this picture.
Like it was his decision. Well, then you need to leave. That's
right.
What he said.
But I don't think he really wanted her to leave.
She said, I'm leaving.
She told him that she was leaving.
And he flipped out.
Yeah, he couldn't handle that because he was in control. He was controlling. He controlled the narrative.
So that means she had already said that to him. Then he started preparing and getting everything.
She had even told friends that she was thinking of leaving.
Right. So that's when he started preparing his kill kit.
Right.
And then said, well, we should just talk. And then she's like, okay, fine, but it's probably not going to matter. And then he used that as an opportunity to have his actual wife and the kids disappear so they couldn't see what he was about to do,
right?
So on and so forth.
Had the house all to himself for a weekend
right.
where he could take care of his problem.
Mm-hmm.
Sean returned emails to friends, trying and failing to mimic Joy's natural tone. So they knew that was not Joy. They knew their friends so well that immediately in receiving those emails, they knew it was not her.
Yeah, the writing style had changed.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Sheila, who was now legally divorced from Sean, testified for the state, telling the jury exactly what she had told the investigators about the weekend that Joy disappeared, that she had gone to Santa Barbara with the boys, and on her way home, Sean had called her and asked her to clean up the blood around the house, and that all those items that he purchased, she did not believe that he purchased those to work on the house because he was not handy. He never did anything. Now, this is what the state believes. The state believes the couple did go out to a fancy dinner. I mean, obviously, because they have receipts for that. Joy called Sheila around 8:30 to say goodnight to the boys. So all of that is true. All of that happened.
And she was still alive.
She was still alive at 8:30.
Right.
They were still, I believe, at dinner when she called Sheila. Now, these are my thoughts. After arriving home, there was either a verbal argument about Joy leaving Sean, and then he stormed out of the house, and she did call him after 9:30 to come back. Or Sean put his plan into action and had already murdered Joy and then called himself from her phone to set up the argument scenario.
Right.
That's kind of what I think happened.
Well,
she was murdered probably right when they walked in that house.
Yeah, when you said that she called him, I was thinking, why?
Right. If she wanted to leave,
that seems more like a cover-up phone call.
Well, yeah. And if she really wanted to leave, she probably would have used that time to start packing. not caring whether or not he was going to come home, start packing up her stuff.
Yeah, if he left, she's like, all right, this is it.
I'd lock all the doors, not let him back in.
Yeah.
Sean then killed Joy, disfigured her, and then left her body with no way to identify her, stuffed her body into the container, and drove her out to the desert, leaving this wonderful and beautiful woman out there to just rot. Ugh. Gosh, these make me so sick sometimes. After 5 days of testimony, the jury deliberated for less than 3 hours and found Sean guilty of the premeditated murder of Joy. Members of the jury said that they never believed Sean's testimony or his fake tears, that it was so fake that it was insulting to them. They used that word. He insulted them.
Wow.
And Sean was sentenced to 25 years to life. Sean is quoted as saying that he has embraced his Christian ministry and his new purpose is to help fellow inmates seek and accept God's forgiveness.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he should not be the one you should counsel
No. Sean resides, as of right now, in Valley State Prison located in Chowchilla, California. I love saying Chowchilla.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why.
Who doesn't want a chowchilla?
It's a chinchilla.
Chinchilla. Whatever it is. The little critter. The little creature thing.
The boys were relocated and have been raised by Sean's brother.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Which Sean's brother was actually an intricate part in the truth being revealed to the church about Sean's polygamist lifestyle. He actually was one of the ones that contacted the church and told them.
Said, hey.
All right, well.
Stay away from my brother.
Here's something that's going to be rather interesting. Sean became eligible for parole in October of 2023 after only serving 20 years of his 25 to life sentence.
Because
he has tentatively been given a parole suitability hearing scheduled for April 11th, 2024. So in just a few days. It's still on the docket right now. It's still scheduled for April 11th.
A parole hearing.
A parole hearing. Now on change.org, you can go in there and sign a petition for him to have to stay and serve his full sentence or not be eligible for parole until he's served 25 years. And there's also a GoFundMe set up by Joy's friends because what he did to her, he should not be getting out anytime soon. And if he is given parole, he'll be out by the end of this year.
So he's what, 51?
54.
Oh.
I think it said 54.
Oh, I was thinking he was like 30 in 2000.
36 in 2003.
Oh, okay. So then he's 57.
Okay. He's in his late 50s.
Okay.
He's in his mid to late 50s.
Gotcha. Wow.
So he can still have a life.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh, you guys. So if you're interested, go sign the petition. I know I'm going to.
Hopefully no church.
I found it yesterday.
Hopefully no church gives him a job as a youth pastor.
No. It sounds like Joy's friends are going to stay on top of this. Mm-hmm. So I'm very thankful for her friends. They sound like wonderful people. Now, an interesting fact. Are you ready for this? In late 2002, Sean had a conversation with a longtime friend of his. They discussed a possible screenplay or book. The subject would be how a person could study techniques investigators use to catch people who commit murder. Learn what mistakes murderers make and how they learn how to get rid of a body so that no evidence is left behind and the perfect murder could be committed. So Sean was a big fan of true crime.
Well, it sounds like he was a big fan of getting away with true crime.
Okay, that, yes. And I hate saying that, a fan of true crime. No, I mean, his brain went there.
Yeah, he was a fan of getting away with crime.
Of learning how to get away with it.
Yeah, he was fascinated with that.
Which, that is scary. That is so scary.
Yeah.
Now, ideas that were discussed between the two friends were cutting up a body into pieces, using acid to disintegrate the body, and then washing it down a drain. Okay, that has been been done before, and it didn't work. Just FYI, people have tried that. It doesn't all go away. Who has that
conversation with a friend?
Right? I mean, we jokingly say how we would kill each other, but not like that. To actually
sit and have a conversation with a friend.
Yeah.
And you go, okay, so what should we do? What would be the best way? Well, you could try this way or this way or this way. Like, that's a weird.
That's even weird for me. I don't think I could have that conversation.
Huh. And then they wanted to write a screenplay for a movie. Yeah, about
it was either a book. Or they were talking about it being either a book or a screenplay. And then another idea was to hide a body where it could never be found. Duh. Like that. Ooh, I never thought of that before.
I think the only way to hide a body without it being found is the scene from Fargo.
That wasn't hidden, though. And that didn't work either because we covered that case.
I know.
Her tooth was found and stuff.
Right.
In 2003, a couple weeks before Joy was murdered, Sean contacted this same friend and told him that things were not working out with Joy, that she was lazy and sloppy, and that he was going to have to get rid of her. She needed to ship up or ship out, is what he said.
So a quote-unquote friend received that information.
And didn't do anything with it.
Didn't do anything with it. And thought that was perfectly acceptable to hear that.
Probably because they sounded like they talked about murder or getting away with murder.
If you regularly had that conversation and then the friend said, hey, she ain't working out. She's really just not doing what I want her to do. I'm probably going to have to get rid of her.
Maybe it sounded sarcastic. Like, oh, yeah, maybe it's time to get rid of her. And then, ha, 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 ha. You know, you do a laugh at the end of it and it's supposed to be funny and sarcastic. Kind of like our show.
Okay. But he's already pushing the limits with the whole polygamous thing. So true. The whole everything about him is really edgy.
He's an edgy guy.
And then, yeah. And then in wrapping himself in the Bible.
We all know how well that works, don't we?
That's where it really gets frustrating.
Yeah.
So people that are horrible and then they wrap themselves in the Bible. Mm-hmm. So it's like double worse, double bad.
Another interesting fact, Sean had three wives at one time.
Stop.
Sean had married another woman by the name of Sharon in 2000. Sharon lived with the family for less than a year. Sean asked her to leave after 8 months. Sean and Sheila both said that Sharon had mental problems and did not mesh with the family. I guess Joy didn't enjoy her at all either.
Three people.
He had three wives at one time. For 8 months, he had three wives.
When does he work?
I don't know.
All right.
And this must have been in Vallejo.
Gotcha.
Mm-hmm.
That's weird because it's not like it happened 75 years ago. It's mm-hmm. like they walk among us is really the bottom line.
Yeah. He said he felt pressured to marry her by another Christian polygamous sect that he was in conference with.
Okay.
So, Daniel, what did you think of my case?
It was horrible.
I know.
And extremely uncomfortable. But you told it so well.
Aw, you're sweet. Unlike Sean. Sean
I don't even know where to begin or end.
Sean is quoted as being a handsome, charismatic character. And when I post pictures of Sean, he is not handsome at all.
Or charismatic. And he's not very handy.
No, he is not attractive. He is not even halfway decent specimen.
Okay, I mean,
so for him to get three wives at one time, what? Especially Joy. Oh my gosh, let me show you Joy. She is gorgeous.
I may not be a handsome fella, but I am extremely handy.
Here's Joy. Doesn't she look like a Joy?
Yeah. You know what's sad? Do you remember that polygamist? There was like a show on TV we were watching.
that I made you watch.
She made me watch. And they were based out of the LA area, kind of. Do you remember that show?
Yes. Okay. It's Seeking Sister Wife.
Yeah. She looks like one of the ladies.
Yes.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yes. I know what you're talking
about. I've been thinking about that episode.
They have a podcast.
While you've been talking about this.
They have a podcast about, because I believe they're Christian polygamists as well. They're not on the show anymore, which I actually miss them. I forget their names, though. They've had a couple wives leave them.
Yeah. And he's kind of...
He's attractive, too.
He's kind of a handsome, charismatic fella.
Absolutely. But so is the wife.
Very fit. And the wife is very fit and attractive. It was kind of weird. Like, why would you want another... I don't know.
Oh, here's a sleazy picture of Sean.
Oh, good.
He's just disgusting. He is. And it's with Joy, so you can see how different they are.
Oh, goodness.
He doesn't deserve her. He never deserved her.
Oh, he's got those eyes.
They're devil eyes. They're shark eyes.
He looks like he would be... I'm trying to place him like almost like someone that he could play the part of the Wolf of Wall Street kind of character.
Like someone who's going to steal your money.
Yeah, but sell, you know, ice cream to ice to an Eskimo kind of thing. Yeah. He kind of seems that kind of like that kind of guy.
But then next to Joy, like, look at her.
Right.
I don't understand. Ugh. Mm-hmm. All right.
That's sad.
This case has been on my radar for a really long time. And I would pick it up and I'd put it down and I'd pick it up and I'd put it down. Because there are a lot of entertainment, quote unquote, entertainment, true crime shows that have featured this case. But they all were very different with their information. It was almost confusing at how different their accounts were, which left me not wanting to do this case in fear of spouting misinformation, because Joy deserves so much better than that. She deserves her true story to be told.
Uh-huh.
And so there were quite a few articles that I was able to read, but even those differed a little bit. Like some were like, Joy met Sean in a cult. Like he was a cult leader. Mm. It was just very confusing to me. So I would put it down because I was like, I can't do this. But then I was able to get the appeal records with the trial transcripts and the court documents. So really about 90% of my information came from those documents.
Gotcha.
So I felt like I could give Joy her story through those documents.
Hmm.
I did watch a few interviews with her friends, and I did see interviews with Linda Kuzin and other people that had worked on this case. So I really tried to take what they said as truth and not the narrator of this entertainment show.
Right.
Now, Dateline did do an episode on this. I think that was done very well. So if you find the Dateline one, that was pretty good. Now, once again, Joy's friends, they just loved her so much. And my heart just broke for them because they were her family. Joy really didn't have a family left after her mom died. They just wanted to support Joy in her decision to be in this type of relationship, I think. But they did see red flags. And they were just young. They didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
They were young, too. That's why they tried so hard to find Joy and to hear her voice, because they knew that she would never have left her boys. They just wanted her. They kept saying, just call me. Call me so I can hear your voice. That was it. You don't have to come home, but I need to hear your voice.
Right.
And those boys were just her entire world, and they were her purpose. So she never would have left them. And they knew that. So I hope that the boys are doing well.
Think how they have to live now, knowing this is the reality. This is the, I mean, obviously now they're adults, but.
Well, like, most of our cases have children involved.
Yeah.
And I always think of that. It's such a selfish act to kill the mother or the father of your children, because it's the kids. It's the kids that are going to suffer.
Well, you've now just...
It's the kids that have nowhere to go.
Yeah, and you've now just set into motion a series of events which will take possibly generations to get over.
I mean, talk about childhood trauma.
That's what I mean. So then now they're going to live their lives, unfortunately, dragging this as their childhood past into mm-hmm. their future relationships, and then and so on and so on, and it just keeps going.
Yeah.
So that's what's happening.
Yeah. And we really need to say thank you to all the family members and the grandparents and the aunts and uncles who take on the responsibility of raising these children and hopefully
yeah.
raising them.
Yeah, where there's
with the truth.
Yeah, where there's a spouse that kills the other spouse and then the one that gets caught goes to prison or whatever. Meanwhile, everyone else is left in the wake of that.
And left picking up the pieces.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, it's just good times. Sad. And I think Sheila moved back home with her family. So I hope she's doing well too. That mm-hmm. has to be a big punch in the face.
Yeah.
All right, Daniel. Well, that's my case. So I think it's time to say goodbye.
Goodbye.
Be careful.
For marriage is a life sentence.
And divorce is always the better option.
Yep.
Bye, guys.
Bye-bye.